I wonder we should start our next session, which is devoted to Matthew Jones talking about what shall we tell Mrs. Gowing, writing the official history of Britain and atomic energy. And let me just say, I was not a student of Margaret's or connected with her institutionally, but she was an enormous... she was a very important mentor for me, both very encouraging when I embarked on writing about the early nuclear history of the Soviet Union, and very important because she set such high standards, which were sometimes very difficult to meet, as she more than once told me about in a very salutary way, I think. So, and when I was writing about the book called, ended up being called Stalin and the Bomb, I took this particular book, Britain at Atomic Energy, as a kind of model of what level do you want to get into the science, on what level, I mean, the sources I had were very different, but that was a kind of model of how to do this, how to think about atomic history. So, Matthew.
Thank you. Thank you, David. And of course, if you people that don't know him, this is David Holloway from Stanford University, author of Stalin and the Bomb. I think Peter Hennessy raised a point about official history in the last session, and that's something we could probably talk about at the round table at the end of today. What I want to talk about right now is the way in which Margaret Gowing went about writing, researching, and publishing the first of these volumes that she was responsible for, Britain and Atomic Energy, the wartime volume. Rather than talk about the contents itself of the volume, and I know there are lots of people here who are very expert in that area, not least David himself, I want to talk about the framing of the volume and the process by which it went through publication. And I think the best place to start then is with Gowing's appointment to the UK Atomic Energy Authority, which came about as a result of an advert placed on the 29th of December 1958 for the combined post of an archivist and a historian to work at the London headquarters of the Atomic Energy Authority. Now, the background to this appointment lies with the Public Records Act of 1958, which put the proper keeping of departmental records in Whitehall on a statutory footing and provided for their potential release after 50 years. This was the beginning of the 50-year rule that was introduced in 1958. And the irony is, in some ways, is that Margaret had served on the Grigg Committee in the 1950s, which had looked at this whole issue of how government departments preserve and archive and then possibly release their records. And so it's from the Grigg Committee recommendations, which she herself hoped to helped to frame, that led to the Public Records Act of 1958. And the Atomic Energy Authority decided its files should be treated as public records under the Act, under the new legislation, and that they would need a departmental records officer to look after them. But it also decided that in view of the historical importance of the atomic energy project and the decision to preserve records of interest to the historian, they would need to appoint someone who was both an archivist and a historian who could then set about creating and writing a history of Britain and nuclear weapons, Britain's experience of nuclear in the nuclear field more generally. Gowing was appointed in June 1959 and quickly set about establishing the principles for destruction and retention of the AEA's records. By the following year, she and the authority were ready to move forward with the research and writing of the history. And it's quite clear from the records in the Cabinet Office and in the Atomic Energy Authority that are preserved about the writing of the history, that she helped to frame the terms on which she would write the history. So she is suggesting the actual terms of reference, helping to draft the way she'd compose the history. So she's almost writing her own job spec to actually compose the history. Different models for a history were considered and rejected by officials. These included a technical study for scientists of the atomic energy program, which Gowing, as we've seen, was not equipped to write because she didn't have the scientific background. There was also a proposal to write a confidential internal history, which would remain classified and so not be released to the public. Or the idea, another model was for a short and more popular account, and this also was rejected. In the end, it was decided to begin a two-volume project, which would offer a synoptic account from 1940 to the creation of the Atomic Energy Authority in 1954. And it was to be described what was called a serious historical work aimed at the intelligent layman, covering the development of policy, analysing important factors and the consequences of decisions taken. But as one official put it, quote, serious in this context is not, of course, meant to be boring, but it does imply history written according to strict critical standards. It will be introduced, in fact, by a rubric to the effect that while the author had been given free access to official documents, she alone was responsible for the statements made and views expressed. And this was something that I think Margaret Gowing helped concoct, this phraseology. And this became the standard form of words with changes of gender, which was used thereafter in the government's later official history series. It was an indicator, of course, that the historian employed by the state would at the same time be free to use their own judgments, interpretations and conclusions on the material they were using. Within the Atomic Energy Authority, it was felt the organisation would gain prestige from this new initiative in the history world, because apart from the Second World War histories, which had been produced by the Cabinet Office, there was no other example in the public service of official history being written at this time in the early 1960s. But questions of a political nature, the Atomic Energy Authority initially felt, should not be discussed by Gowing in any published book. Examples given were the reasons why Britain decided to develop atomic weapons, or subjects such as international control of atomic energy and the conduct of tests. While the AEA would not be restrictive in how the history was assembled, it would also retain control over the final decision of whether or not to publish. A small advisory committee of three professional academics was also formed in order to provide some oversight for the project and to give some additional confidence to the historical profession that its standards were rigorous. In fact, the first chair of that advisory committee was Sir Charles Webster, who Mick referred to earlier. He died in summer of 1961, so his place had to be taken by G.C. Allen, the economic historian from UCL. The Cabinet Secretary's approval, and the Cabinet Secretary at this time was Sir Norman Brooke, for publication would have to be sought, it was decided, as the history could not be written from AEA records alone, but would need access to the records of the Cabinet and Cabinet committees. Now, the injunction against discussion against political subjects was clearly impossible in practice to uphold. Presentation of basic policy questions concerning such matters as official attitudes to the post-war development of atomic energy or Anglo-American relations were bound to carry a political flavour. And Gowing was determined that these subjects, similar to those that she had already written about in British War Economy, would be properly addressed in her own history. AEA officials will also need to consider what they called the status of Mrs. Gowing, particularly, of course, as she was an AEA employee. And this is something that was considered especially important. One official said, quote, she puts the point, which I'm sure is well-founded, that the weight which a publication will carry in informal circles, particularly among professional historians, is directly proportional to the freedom accorded to the writer, i.e. something in which he or she has a completely free hand will be seriously regarded, something which is no more than an official handout will be disregarded. The chairman of the AEA, and this is Sir Roger Makins, the chairman of the AEA at the time, to whom Gowing directly reported with her work on the history, later said it was important, quote, to demonstrate that the finished text is not a whitewashing operation. It's a direct quote from Makins. But the AEA also recognised that to give Gowing a completely free hand was not conceivable, and the authority had to reserve the right to suggest alterations to the text if an interest of the authority was liable to be prejudiced by what's proposed. By June 1960, Norman Brooke, the Cabinet Secretary's permission had been attained by Makins to proceed with the historical work. And Makins wrote to Gowing to confirm he wanted her to produce, quote, an objective historical work and not an official eulogy. And all the time, it's very interesting to read the files. Gowing is given consistently strong support by Makins, her boss at the Atomic Energy Authority, in the way she goes about the work and the access to files that she's trying to reach and the conclusions she wants to draw herself. Now, within the Cabinet Office, Norman Brooke, the Cabinet Secretary, manages to ascertain that there was no precedent for the enterprise of a department taking the initiative in devising and writing such a history. One of his officials wrote that while he imagined on the technical side of the question, objections to an official atomic energy history had largely disappeared, the political aspect may well be another matter. But the consensus of opinion was that as long as the AEA reserved the right to consider amendments or omissions, or to deny permission to publish at all, it was a worthwhile venture, quote, and might well provide valuable lessons for the future. Gowing began all-out work on history at the beginning of 1961, backed up by her advisory committee of academics. One cabinet office official needlessly minuted, quote, one must hope that Mrs. Gowing will not find it a little overpowering. By the summer of 1961, Gowing was pushing at several Whitehall doors, managing to gain access to the Prime Minister's office files, then kept at Admiralty House, and Foreign Office documents as well, from sometimes reluctant officials. And all the time, making, smoothing her way beforehand with letters of introduction and so forth. And in May 1961, it also became public knowledge that an official history was in the works, which made it much more difficult to prevent publication later on in the process. By the early summer of 1963, a first draft of the book was complete. Now, it's remarkable to me, you know, spent quite a few years now working on official history, that it's less than 2 years, really, that she spends on this work before a first draft is produced. And a pleased Makins sent a text to the new cabinet secretary. Of course, this is now, by now, it's the summer of 1963, Sir Bert Trend. And Trend is here on the right, who's replaced Brooke as cabinet secretary. Makins rests his case for quick publication on the recent appearance in 1962 of the US Atomic Energy Commission's own official history, The New World. So the Americans have got there first with their wartime official history, and the memoirs of General Leslie Groves, of course the wartime head of the Manhattan Project. Groves published Now It Can Be Told at about this time as well. The military historian Michael Howard had reviewed the Groves book in the Sunday Times and made the point that the British side of events was in danger of going by default if the mooted AEA history was not produced. It was also important, Howard argued, that the British history should be no less frank and open than the American. Trend and Cabinet Office officials did, however, have a problem with some areas of the text that they saw. And probably most significantly in the summer of 1960, or in the spring and summer of 1963, the most important part of the narrative that they found problems with was Gowing's account of the meeting between Niels Bohr and Churchill in May 1944. An unfortunate encounter, in fact. Now, there are lots of more experts around the table than me on the subject of Niels Bohr and his activities in his career, in his wartime meeting with Churchill, not least Kevin Horan, who's written part of this account up in his recent book on Churchill and the bomb. But Bohr had been spirited out of Copenhagen, wartime Denmark, to Sweden by British intelligence in 1943, brought to London, then he'd gone on to the United States to work on the Manhattan Project in late 1943, and he'd come back to London in the spring of 1944, deeply concerned about the post-war prospects for a nuclear arms race, and the urgent need to establish international controls over atomic energy. And Bohr, supported by senior figures such as Sir John Anderson and Frederick Lindemann, had engineered a meeting with Churchill, where he tried to explain his anxieties about the post-war world and the prospect of a nuclear arms race. One of his prescriptions, which is to inform the Russians that the Anglo-American work on the atomic bomb was underway in an effort to build trust with the Russians, did not go down well with Churchill. By some accounts, Bohr had engaged in his characteristic mumbling, and an impatient and annoyed Churchill had dismissed him out of hand. Churchill even followed up with a minute asking whether Bohr might represent a security risk. As R.V. Jones, the British scientist, wartime scientist with connections with the intelligence world, put it, at best he regarded Bohr as a blue-eyed, long-haired old scientist who had no idea of the realities of war. At worst, he was half inclined to lock Bohr up. Here the two men are. So it was not a very... Now, it was well known by the early 60s at this time that Bohr had tried a similar approach to Roosevelt later on in the same year, in 1944, in August 44. He suggested that the Soviets be told about the project. And the fact of a project was going on. And the American authors of the AEC history had put that in their own account. But the earlier meeting with Churchill was really unknown about up to this point in published accounts. And so really, this was Gowing's scoop for her volume. But the Cabinet Office soon raised objections to the draft that Gowing chose to present. In a convention that arose in the early 50s, the Cabinet Secretary had taken it upon himself to ensure that what were called Sir Winston Churchill's interests were taken into account in the production of the wartime series of official histories. Trend now assumed he should apply the same principle for the Gowing volume, as it too covered the war years. One Cabinet Office official wondered if publication would lead to the possibility of criticism of Churchill as, quote, the man chiefly responsible for the loss of an opportunity to prevent a post-war atomic arms race. There was also concern that because of the outcome of his May 1944 meeting with Bohr, Churchill will appear to be the principal author of the controversial third clause of the Hyde Park Agreement of September 1944. Now, Churchill had met Roosevelt at Roosevelt's residence at Hyde Park in September 1944, crafted an aide memoir with three paragraphs. In the first two of these paragraphs, the two statesmen had stressed post-war collaboration over atomic energy between Britain and the United States. But the third clause of the aide memoir agreed at Hyde Park had mentioned that Bohr should be investigated as a potential security risk. This clause had not been reproduced in the AEC, American official history, although the first two had. And it was thought it was not published because it contained an implied doubt about the security reliability of the famous scientist of Niels Bohr. Gowing wanted to print the document in its entirety for the first time. Now, in July 1963, Trend writes to Sir Anthony Montagu Brown, who was Churchill's private secretary. And of course, we now know he's Justin Welby's father. That's a recent twist of fate. You can probably see the family resemblance. So Anthony Montagu Brown became Churchill's private secretary in 1959, when Churchill was in retirement, of course. So Trend writes to Montagu Brown to warn him that publication of this text, as it stood, could invoke critical reflection on Churchill's judgment of an outstanding personality. After he consulted Churchill, so Montagu Brown talked to Churchill about this, he replies there was a need for Gowing's account to provide more context on relations of the Soviet Union, to explain to readers why really Churchill might have had his doubts about the wisdom of sharing this knowledge with the, well, knowledge of the fact of the atomic work with the Soviet Union. As Montagu Brown put it, quote, every event underlined the sinister and shark-like egotism of Russian foreign policy under Stalin. The custodians of Churchill's reputation were evidently concerned that he should be regarded as an innately untrustworthy. He should regard the Soviet Union as innately untrustworthy. And he wanted to see the text modified to include reference, for example, to the Soviet withholding of aid to the Warsaw Uprising later on in 1944. Now, Gowing did actually go on to modify her text to indicate that Churchill was not oblivious to the post-war implications of atomic energy, and that his suspicions of the Soviet Union were to some extent justified. Montagu Brown eventually told Cabinet Office officials that the changes were acceptable to Churchill in September 1963. But Trend went even further, suggesting to Makins that Gowing remove her summing up of the whole affair, as he felt it overpraised the scientist. And once more, Gowing did remove her own comments, her own summarised comments of the meeting between Bohr and Churchill. In the end of her account. But now Makins really stepped in as Gowing's defender and prevented any more changes to the text. He said the text should stand, could now stand, and that Makins would regret it very much if material was withheld, simply because it might be held to reflect in some minor way on the Prime Minister of the day. He said to Trend, it would be contrary to the intention and purpose of this history to produce a restrained document which would inevitably smack of censorship, and to leave the field to the full and frank American history. Gowing herself remained insistent that the third clause of the Hyde Park Agreement be published. Her coverage of the episode had made quite clear that Bohr was not a security risk, far from it. In fact, his record had been checked by British security, he'd been cleared by the security service, and any approaches he got from the Russians at this time, he always reported them to the security authorities, and they regarded him as very trustworthy and reliable. It's also important that Gowing to know this, that Gowing had travelled to Copenhagen twice in early 1962 to interview Bohr and had built up a relationship with Bohr and his family. She called her first encounter with him, with Niels Bohr, lasting 4 hours, the most wonderful talk in the world. And she was obviously very impressed with him. She also gave Bohr her first draft of the history to read, including the meeting with Churchill, and told him what was in the third clause of the Hyde Park Agreement. Now, Bohr had died in November 1962, but he had evidently no objection to Gowing's story being told for the benefit of history. And the Bohr family also wanted to see the story told rather than the suppression, as they called it, of an essential truth. Michael Carey, a deputy undersecretary at the Cabinet Office, was not surprised that the Bohr family was happy to see Gowing's account appear, as Bohr, quote, emerges with the highest credit. It is by no means clear the reader would reach the same conclusion about Sir Winston Churchill. So Makins eventually backs Gowing on this issue, and Trend was finally persuaded and prepared to acquiesce over the publication of the third clause of the Hyde Park Agreement. It was considered to be a very uncontentious subject, finally. But further problems about publications arose in the summer of 1963. The Foreign Office received a draft of the text in the summer and were unperturbed about its political and diplomatic contents. The admissions, for example, that there was fault on both sides of the wartime Anglo-American relationship, as the Foreign Office said, ought to disarm all but a few professional Anglophobes. As for the passages which, when Churchill in early 1945 had rejected the idea of a close collaboration with France in the nuclear field, in general the narrative shows that HMG put themselves in the position of having to choose between the Americans and the French and chose the Americans. This is only an example of a continuing problem, and nothing can be done to conceal it, even though it may be exploited against HMG by French propagandists. Nevertheless, the Foreign Office is very relaxed about this publication. Trend detects, however, some potential problems with the treatment in the volume, because he writes to Makins in August 63 to warn him that some reference to ministers might be required prior to publication. And the reason is this, because the summer of 1963, the partial test ban treaty had just been signed between the United States, Britain and the Soviet Union. And of course, unbeknownst to Gowing and others, there was a private correspondence going on between Macmillan and Kennedy over the possibility of bringing the French into the partial test ban regime, perhaps by offering them some nuclear information about the results of testing to actually stop the French test in the atmosphere. Now, this eventually got nowhere. I mean, the idea was eventually discounted. The French were never approached with this as a formal proposal, but it was at least under discussion as a possible way to get the French to sign on to the partial test ban treaty through the transfer of some information. Trend wrote to Katcher, "No doubt our rather nationalistic approach during the war and the acquisition of nuclear knowledge and power is generally known, but should we not satisfy ourselves that there is no ministerial objection to giving de Gaulle a fresh supply of chapter and verse?" So it was feared that if this book was published at the time negotiations were going on, it could prejudice, you know, French views of the British and the Americans. But Makins and Gowing evidently felt that too much was being made of the issue. American books and French memoirs had already told this story dozens of times of attitudes to France at the end of the war, and Makins thought that a frank and sympathetic account of the story is helpful to the present case rather than the reverse. The irony did not escape officials, however, that now Trend wanted to consult the Prime Minister, of course there was Macmillan at this time, in September 1963, on whether his own family firm, Macmillan's, the publisher, should proceed to publish this book, Britain and Atomic Energy. At the end of September 1963, Heath, who was Lord Privy Seal and so in the Foreign Office, wrote to Macmillan, drawing his attention to the foreign policy aspects of Gowing's book, including the Anglo-French aspects. But Heath, again, was not overly concerned. On the whole, I think we can take a relaxed view. This is, after all, history of events of 20 years ago, and the fact the French scientists left the wartime project with no other benefit other than the substantial knowledge they gained by participation in it is well known. Publication would have no influence on French policy, and delay would only raise embarrassing questions. When, after all, will be a better moment, especially as the Americans were in any case publishing their own histories. But all was not plain sailing. Macmillan was said to be not too happy with all this, and wanted to discuss with his Foreign Secretary, Lord Hume, after October's Conservative Party conference, the whole subject. However, of course, Macmillan's illness and then enforced retirement before the Conservative Party conference meant it would now be the new Prime Minister, Alec Douglas Hume, on the left here, the former Foreign Secretary, who would receive a minute from Trend in October explaining the publications for explaining the plans for publication of the Gowing history. By now, the new Foreign Secretary, Rab Butler, was hoping that publication would proceed, while Makins felt that it was, quote, impossible to believe the book could have any adverse effect on Anglo-French relations. In fact, Makins was becoming alarmed by the signs of delay, asking Trend, can we not assume that Sir Alec Douglas Hume as Prime Minister will agree with Lord Hume as Foreign Secretary? Because, of course, the Foreign Office had been relaxed. But it, of course, did turn out the ministerial office did matter. When approached about the subject in November 1963, Douglas Hume indicated that while he approved publication, he favoured postponement until the end of 1964, because the timing of publication had now become a political matter. Downing Street officials were already beginning to think about the election that would have to take place by October 1964. They did not relish the prospect of a book appearing under official auspices, which might arouse controversy over nuclear matters, especially when the issue of Britain's nuclear independence or otherwise become a major issue of political contention between the Labour and Conservative parties in the run-up to the 64 election. By now, Butler agreed, minuting, I should let it slip until the end of the year. He means publication. This should be quite easy to achieve. But Trend was not so sure it could be possible to engineer such without a leak. How, he asked, should Mrs. Gowing present... How should Makins present the postponement to Macmillan's and to Mrs. Gowing? So the question became, what to tell Mrs. Gowing? Is there any risk that they would put it out, deliberately or inadvertently, the postponement is due to internal political considerations, and that meanwhile Britain's contribution to the atomic war effort is being allowed to go unsung? Now, several fixes were suggested. Some external political reason could be offered to explain delay, but it was thought so the Foreign Office could perhaps concoct some excuse for why the volume should be delayed. But, of course, it was felt difficult for the Foreign Office to invent something that would happen in the future in order to prevent the publication of the volume in the future. And the Foreign Office didn't like to be tempted into that kind of forecasting. Gowing could be told nothing, but instead Macmillan's, the publisher, and this is a lovely quote, perhaps through the good offices of their most illustrious director, because also now Macmillan is in retirement, so now Macmillan perhaps could be approached to invent some delay at the publishing side with his family firm, or to create what they called an artificial mechanical delay in publication, whatever that means. Or they could simply hold up approval in other ways. In early December 1963, Makins and Trend in fact agreed that the Cabinet Secretary would approach and see Macmillan to try to get his cooperation in delaying publication. And this in fact was subsequently agreed to by Macmillan when he talked to Trend about the matter in early 1964. But, of course, we know eventually Britain and Atomic Energy was published on the 24th of September 1964, a good 3 weeks before the general election. So what had happened? Bemused Cabinet Office officials wondered what could have gone awry with their scheme that they had concocted at the end of the previous year. In fact, Trend had to tell Douglas Hume on the 17th of September that his instructions to the publisher, relayed through Macmillan, the former Prime Minister, had been disregarded, and he was not sure why. When informed, Macmillan had simply said, Macmillan said, oh, it's too late now, review copies had already been distributed, and the BBC was about to feature the book that evening on one of its programmes. As one Cabinet Office official said, the horse had bolted. Now, the publication of Britain and Atomic Energy didn't cause any of the stirs which had been feared in some corners of Whitehall. Trend himself thought Gowing's book was an admirable production, scholarly and scrupulously fair. General Leslie Groves wrote to Margaret Gowing to express his admiration for the book. And it strikes up an unusual kind of friendship between Groves, you know, a figure you identify really on the conservative right in the United States, I suppose, and Gowing. And they had a very, very friendly conversation. And a warm correspondence. Oppenheimer wrote to Margaret Gowing when he received his own copy of the book from Penny. Penny sent Oppenheimer a copy. And Oppenheimer said, he read it with great interest and admiration. I know of the special concern so much appreciated in Copenhagen to get the Bohr story straight. I think you succeeded beautifully. That's from Oppenheimer. Mm. I want to finish off by looking at, you know, what next? How do you explain the path from the wartime volume to the next volume? So I think this is a really interesting story which opens up some new dimensions as well. In the preface to Britain and Atomic Energy, Gowing had referred to a sequel volume, and in mid-1964 the AEA began to ask the Cabinet Office about its attitude to a successor volume. But officials at this time in the Cabinet Office balked. They were concerned by the greater political controversies which would surround post-war events and personalities. If a post-1945 volume were to be written, they felt it would not be publishable. But of course, Gowing had included in her preface reference to a successor volume. So she'd already kind of opened that can of worms up quite nicely. The trump card, the AAA, also said that the Americans were planning another successor volume to cover the late 1940s and the 1950s. So where would that leave matters on the British side? Another problem that arose in any effort to prevent a successor volume being written was the parliamentary question asked of the Prime Minister in July 1964. Douglas Hume responded to this question about the imminent publication of Gowing's book and mentioned the publication of a first volume. And this was an answer that Trenn thought was very tiresome, because of course it was, because it meant that the Prime Minister had put on record the fact that there was a first volume, so there would be a second. Within the Cabinet Office, it was appreciated that a Gowing post-war volume would blow a large hole in the 50-year rule established in 1958 for the release of public records. A reassessment of the 50-year rule would seem to be necessary if a second Gowing volume was to be published. But some in the Cabinet Office also saw a possible solution in the commissioning of a whole series of peacetime official histories. On the 15th of October 1964, the day after the general election, Lord Penny, who had taken the place of Makins by now at the AEA, met Trenn to discuss the second volume issue. Trenn was clearly worried by the difference in principle between a wartime and a post-war study. Penny agreed but thought the main case for a volume two would rest on the need to have a British volume to counterbalance the American history that they knew was being written. Once Britain on Atomic Energy was out in 1964, Gowing was also keen to press ahead with her successor volume and take the story till 1954. Although on balance supportive, not least as Gowing's first volume had been so well received, Trenn realised that letting her loose on post-war cabinet papers and the documents of other departments raised a new precedent. There were already calls from the historical profession and the interested public to reduce the closure period on public records from 50 years. If Gowing was given privileged access, they could become difficult to resist. It would also mean official history stepping into the post-war period, and peacetime events, when hitherto there had only been official war histories. A post-war volume therefore raised the issue of whether the government should embark upon a new series of histories dealing with aspects of government policy after 1945. Now, Trenn put all these issues to Harold Wilson, the new Prime Minister, in January 1965. And Trenn's own position, interestingly enough, was supportive, calling the UK's post-war atomic energy contribution largely unknown and ignored. Once more mentioning the US AEC history that was in the works, and although it should be, quote, not merely as a matter of national interest or prestige, but the sake of historical completeness and accuracy that this work should be finished. There was, he reminded the Prime Minister, quote, the danger of the British case going by default. The problem was a post-war volume would delve into such sensitive matters as the tightly restricted handling of atomic energy matters by Attlee and a few senior ministers, and for that reason, the government would still need to reserve final decisions over publication. The Cabinet Secretary also used this minute to propose a scheme for a series of officially sponsored peacetime histories, with the Gowing volume as, in effect, a pilot. After discussing this with Trenn, Harold Wilson decided to authorise the Gowing work and even smoothed the way with a letter to Lord Attlee, asking him delicately to cooperate with Gowing with an interview. In a shaky hand, it's a wonderful letter preserved by Attlee on the files, in a really shaky hand, Attlee replies that he was willing to speak to Gowing, but probably was not much use considering the state of his memory, which is a familiar problem for official historians talking to people of retired statesmen. Recognising the sensitivity of the material, he also shared some of Trenn's reservations about any advance commitment to publication. On the 1st of March 1965, Trenn finally wrote to Penny at the AEA to tell him that the formal go-ahead had been given by ministers to a volume two, with Gowing accorded access to all relevant documents. However, Gowing was already at work at number 10 on the Prime Minister's Office archive. Assuming a Gowing volume would be, a successor volume would be given the go-ahead, Trenn used the occasion to suggest this scheme for the commissioning of official histories to the Prime Minister. And Wilson seemed well disposed to that idea as well. The following year, in 1966, the Cabinet Office duly established an official history programme to cover peacetime events. Gowing's next volume, Independence and Deterrence, when it was finally published in 1974, became the first peacetime official history. But the pressure for a Gowing successive volume, coming from both the author and the AEA, also had the effect of forcing the reform of the 50-year rule. The rule had already come under criticism, as I said before, by the historical profession, and pressure had been mounting for the release of wartime documents in particular. In March 1967, Wilson announced to the House of Commons that the closed period for public records would be reduced to 30 years, the standard period that lasted until fairly recently. So to conclude, while the publication of Britain and Atomic Energy, Gowing left historians and the public with a classic work that showed how British scientists and engineers and their emigre partners had been pivotal to the arrival of the atomic age. The ups and downs of atomic cooperation with the United States have been charted, and the UK's contribution to the Manhattan Project explained. Contemporary issues relevant to the political debates of the 60s and after, such as the degree of nuclear independence enjoyed by Britain or the extent of dependence on the United States, could now be put in their proper context. It was also clear that many of those involved with the British wartime project had taken it as axiomatic that a post-war program would and should be undertaken. Most of all, the book made for a better informed public, and I think that was a very important part of why she wanted to carry out this work. Throughout this formative period in post-war official history, Gowing set a crucial later standard through her insistence that her independence and academic integrity should not be compromised. She would have access to all relevant papers, but the interpretation of the findings and views and opinions expressed would be her own. But aside from all this, the process of writing and compiling the history, including the question of a successor volume, had helped to break down some of the previous barriers of public access to history. Gowing's endeavours contributed to the launch of both the peacetime official history series within the Cabinet Office, the last fruits of which are still being seen today, and prompted the Wilson government to reduce the closure period for public records to 30 years, a reform which opened up a whole new swathe of Second World War and Cold War history to researchers in the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah. Great. Thank you very much. That's great. Let me open the floor to questions, comments. Yes.
I'm Sebastian Cox. I'm the Royal Air Force's official historian, another prostitute in the room, I suppose. Matt, I'm interested by what part was played, if any, by this advisory committee. Who appointed it, then? B, I note that Sir Charles Webster is one of the original members. Now, it wasn't mentioned that Webster's been mentioned, but the fact that he was the official historian of the Strategic Air Offensive has not. And that, of course, generated great controversy at the time. And it was Brooke who actually told the Air Ministry that they couldn't prevent certain things being published in the Ministry that they did want to be published. So I find it interesting that Webster is appointed to the advisory committee. And who's appointed the advisory? And did they play any part in assisting Gowing to publish what she wanted to publish?
That's a great question. It leads into a number of different areas as well. I mean, Webster, if you're interested in what Seb's just said, Noble Franklin's memoir, History at War, is a really good source for the background to the writing of the official history on the Bomber Command's role in the war. And, I mean, the Webster input into that history hadn't been too heavy. I think it'd be more Noble Franklin, wasn't it? But Webster had experience, obviously, of the negotiations with Whitehall about the publication of the history, which had been very difficult in the late 50s and early 60s. But I see no role whatsoever for this advisory committee in pushing the Cabinet Office or other government officials into, allowing publication to go forward or without amendment. It's a very, very light touch it exercises. And, of course, after Webster dies and G.C. Allen takes over, I think they were circulated with some early drafts, but I don't see them reading a complete final draft. I think they are there, I mean, and they are pretty much nominated through Margaret Gowing herself. You know, she's being asked, who do you know that you could ask to be on this advisory committee? So she is proposing the names to officials in the Atomic Energy Authority who are then writing to academic historians saying, would you mind serving on this committee and so forth. So it is very much kept in this insular circle, this advisory committee of three.
And she hadn't had makings.
she hadn't have had Makin's, I think she would have had a much, much rougher ride, much more difficult ride.
So because she used them?
Would she have used them? I think she probably would have turned to use them if she hadn't have had Makin's there as her stop for that.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
No, you go first.
Okay. Yeah. Kevin Ruane, Canterbury Christchurch. As Matthew mentioned, I've done a little bit of work on the ball thing, and I'm going to make a couple of observations and then ask a question, if I may. Mm. First of all, we need to remember that when Churchill met ball, it's May 1944, it was a fortnight before D-Day, and I think we'll give Churchill a little bit of distraction in the first instance. Secondly, Churchill repeatedly says, and some of you may know this, that scientists should be on tap and never on top. And so he kind of feels a little bit uncomfortable about that. And thirdly, he was ganged up on. He didn't want the meeting. So Lindemann says have the meeting. Field Marshal Smuts says have the meeting. Lord Halifax in Washington says have the meeting. Mm. He's number two in Washington, has the meeting. He began to say, we thought this was a secret. I did wonder how many people actually knew about the most secret thing in the war. But so all those things kind of coalesce, and you do get a kind of spiky and negative, very negative Churchill reaction. But the question now kind of morphs from that, which is that you mentioned the correspondence that you've seen between Margaret Gowing and Niels Bohr connected with her visits to him. It's not uncommon in people who met Bohr to come away in a state of massive admiration and respect. And you can infer from that Margaret Gowing did indeed admire and respect Niels Bohr. And so the question comes in, we heard an awful lot this morning about Margaret Gowing as a woman of the left. She gets this job, Matthew, you said 1959, Aldermaston first march, 1958. It wouldn't be unusual, given her political trajectory, for her to have opinions in private about the bomb. And I just wonder if you might be able to comment on the kind of connection between the private Margaret Gowing and the official historian. Have we got the irony of an official historian of the bomb who might actually not like the bomb very much?
I think it's a wonderful... Again, another wonderful angle. I mean, just going. I will address that question in a second. But of course, there are no. I don't think we have any actual minutes of the meeting between Churchill and Bohr. We have lots of accounts of. Yeah. And Anderson was there, wasn't he? And I think the first was Anderson present, or was it? Lindemann was there. And the first few minutes of the meeting is spent with Churchill complaining to Lindemann of actually holding the meeting. You know, so it's not a very edifying event. But in terms of Gowing's own personal views, I think we talked to Roy MacLeod about this, and interviewed Roy MacLeod, and I think you'll see later on a discussion with Roy MacLeod that's being filmed for today, and he wrote, of course, this biographical memoir. And one of the questions I had for him, did you know? I mean, what was her private attitude towards nuclear weapons? It's difficult to discern through the actual text. I mean, what you see in this book, though, is when she talks about the use of the atomic bomb against Japan in 1945, she shows tremendous understanding for the pressures that, you know, the Americans were under at that time, and says, I think she uses the phrase, and all my students will be very familiar with this, from a quotation we actually take from the book and discussed a few weeks ago, but it would have required unbelievable, almost impossible restraint on anyone to hold back that decision-making process that led to the use of the bombs in 1945.
Can I tell you my recollection as a 17, 18-year-old son of Margaret Gowing, that I actually remember speaking to her about the dropping of the bomb, and she certainly was not wildly against the principle in the context of what was happening in Japan. And the ironical thing is, her husband was the first officer into Nagasaki after the dropping of the atomic bomb. So she actually, through that mechanism, had direct knowledge of the reality of what had happened. So I can tell you from speaking to her informally in the sitting room that she certainly was not vehemently anti the bomb.
But she went through the life into the late 50s.
But
you can disconnect the atomic bombing of 1945, which even Niels Bohr himself thought was probably on balance a necessary thing. And then, as you see, how these horrendous weapons then developed thereafter. you can have a different sort of view.
Yeah, it's only that marker that stuck out for me.
I remember very vividly sitting in our living room, and I was only 9 years old in 1963 during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you know the tension just in our household during that week or 2 weeks of what was the world going to come through the next 2 weeks. She never actually said then what her feeling was, but obviously,
there was great
fear.
I think there's something I wrote, I can't remember exactly, but quote it exactly, but something she wrote in the early 80s where she said that, you know, the nuclear debate, people tend to be demonised. You know, if you're sort of not arguing for unilateral disarmament, the left will attack you for being, you know, effectively a warmonger, you know, somebody who's, and then at the same time, you know, if you're not the other way. So she said she was kind of like trying to steer this middle course, I think, between these two poles. I mean, she certainly was in favour of multilateral disarmament, you know, as moderate Labour would be. But I don't see her as being kind of, you know, unilateralist inclined. I mean, that's all. And it's difficult. I mean, because I never knew her. I know I only can go on what I've read from what she's written. But that's the way I feel.
Can I add something?
Yes.
John Hendry, I worked with her on The Successors, which never happened. Independent of deterrence. Lorna Arnold was anti-war.
Yes, yes, yes.
And very clearly, they had a dynamic in the office. I at the time was also, I'd be married by a chap called Bruce Kent. The vetting process was quite interesting. Phone tap for quite a period and so on before getting onto this project. But Margaret. She kept her about it. She wouldn't commit herself. Yeah. But I think with Lorna being quite clearly against the bomb and writing her superb histories afterwards, I think Margaret tended to position herself more away from that opposition. But that's all the place.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that great paper. On the Webster story, just a quick one, James. You know, Webster was here at the LSE, and he did the volume, The Noble Franklin, on Bomb Command. I don't know if you know the story too, that he actually went to Frank Harris to kind of get advice, and later Harris wrote, "I wish that damn communist from that communist institution wouldn't have come here." That LSE has done more to destroy the British Empire than any other single institution in the whole damn world. Well, so the conversation didn't go too well with Harris.
Of course, Bert Harris hadn't actually read it.
No, he had not read it at all. He just knew this man was from the LSE. Yeah. If anybody knew C.K. Webster, the least likely communist I've ever known in my whole life. But anyway, that's not a question. Just two questions. My reading, not as a nuclear historian, but as a historian, reading Margaret's first volume, it's got an underlying patriotism about it. I think you said that in your very first review many years ago, when Laurie was by chance read the other day. I wonder if that again was a major factor in its publication in the end, because it's telling a very British story.
Yeah.
It's an untold.
I think that's the most telling and strongest argument that's all constantly wheeled out in his
inside. Let me get that out of the way. The other thing is, what about the coincidence of the Wilson government? Does that make any difference at all to publications? Or if I had all the decisions already.
Oh, the decision's already been taken before the Wilson government.
What about
arrived.
The other one then, Matt, on the kind of underlying page? It's telling a British story. It's telling a story about. Yeah. Cambridge, Manchester, and Birmingham, rather than.
Yeah, no, I think the fact
United
that.
States, United States, United States.
You know, the fact that the Americans are. Coming forward with the AEC is coming forward with the American histories is a really, really compelling reason why the British authorities felt, well, you know, these matters, although, I mean, the sensitivity of the volumes is how close they are to the events that they're describing. You know, 20 years in terms of this, sort of more like, 20 years in terms of the successor volume in the early 50s as well, which broke this, you know, broke the 50-year-old completely. Yeah. And so they're a little bit worried about that. But I think the fact that the AEC histories were being produced, so most of the story was being told anyway by the Americans, that there were no sort of real secrets about this program that were, but the British side was not being told. The British side of the story was just being neglected. And there was a need to, also, I mean, Gowing felt, I think, that it was important to speak to people that were involved with the program. So she did oral history interview work, and she was very keen to do that, obviously, before people's memories, you know, lapsed and so on, while she could get to people. So she felt the need to do this work, you know, within a reasonable period of the events being described as well.
And she was very proud of a lot of these people as well. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I said, I mean, I wanted to get that across. Her real heroes were these figures, you know, absolutely. Bill Penny, James Chadwick. And she says that, I mean, there's one letter that she writes to Chadwick. She says, look, the thing I enjoyed most about this whole process of writing this volume was meeting you guys, you know, basically. That's what I got the best thing. You know, my best experience was talking to you about your experiences and actually bringing forward these figures, you know, because Chadwick was a very kind of quiet, modest man, but she credits him hugely with the success, the ultimate success of Anglo-American collaboration, you know, say in 1944 in the Manhattan Project, because Chadwick got on very well with Leslie Groves. Groves trusted Chadwick, I think, very, very, you know, very, very implicitly, really. Whereas he'd been wary about some of the other contacts he'd had with the British in the past, you know, if you look at the relations in 1943. So, you know, it's bringing forward figures like Chadwick that she manages to do in that text, who would have been, you know, pretty much on those.
I have a letter to Chadwick in which Chadwick, as I said earlier, at the Churchill College in Cambridge, in which she says that she was unable to publish this, but it was striking how actively James B. Collins, who was the head of the S1 executive, one of the key figures on the side, how actively he was working against British interests during the war. So Groves.
And she brings that out.
I have a couple of hands up, but if I could interject a point to come back to Niels Bohr. When I was writing about the Soviet Union, she was, I think, very hopeful that I would show that Bohr's approach would have worked. In other words, it would have headed off an arms race. And I think she was a bit disappointed that I didn't manage to show that. I mean, she was genuine. I shouldn't say hopeful. She was just genuinely interested to know, well, if we're looking at the Soviet side, how might Stalin have responded? Since, after all, he knew a great deal about the Manhattan Project, you know. So, and we do know that the use of the bomb against Hiroshima came as a big shock and really turned their program into a crash program. So, but it's difficult to know how that approach itself, telling him about it, would it have established trust? What would have been entailed then in saying, okay, we'll consult about the bombing of Japan, and if Stalin had said, no, we're coming into the war, it'll be over without the bomb, don't use it. So, anyway, sorry. Yes, John, and then Laurie.
Two comments on the patriotism front. Senator Lorna Arnold was always of the view, I think the older she got, that this was a story about Britain had to be told, very upset about it, being downplayed or ignored. I felt an awful lot more to be said, except for that first volume. Certainly there's more to be said about that story now, given some of the papers that are now available, so it can be amplified further. And I think the other thing with the strength of both of the histories, which I alluded to, Matthew, was the connection between documentary review and oral history. It's very instrumental in that history. It comes across in both volumes very clearly. And of course, the proximity of the events, you know, memories were still fresh, present, music were fresh, made an enormous difference, I think, telling the story.
And it's wonderfully written. I mean, it's a real delight to read, this book.
My question. The first, I think it's fascinating to see the importance of the sponsorship at the highest level. First experience, well, a load of problems. It's a brothel of its official historians. It makes a difference when as soon as you hit trouble. If you don't have that support, you can see how easy you can get wrong. But my question, there's a lot of references to the fact that the Americans were getting the stuff out and so on, and I'm sure part of the patriotism and the socialism is in A, what you can do with planning, which is an important part of the political argument at the time, and also this sort of slight tension with the Americans, not just to be following them. But that leads to the American official history, the unity and Anderson. Mm. I mean, ages since I've read it, but my recollection is written in a completely and totally different style.
Style.
Mm.
Yeah.
The first sort of flowery stuff he was just sending me on in Washington. Mm. There's the portrait figure, so, you know. And it was that sort of thing. Mm. And I was wondering what she thought of the American Edith and Anderson.
I haven't read anything that indicates, you know, what she felt about that, the history.
It's sort of the absence of the British story that was criticised, which is really unique, you can see. But stylistically, it's completely different. Mm. And just as a historian, also, again, from memory, the Margaret is much more judgmental in a way, I mean, much more interpretive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also.
I
wasn't able to. I mean, maybe some people here know this, but and I wasn't able to do the research to get into this one issue. But there's references to. I mean, John Ehrman, who was an official historian, wrote an account called "The Atomic Bomb," I think, on the use of the bomb again, or the Wurzeln project, and it was never released. It was an internal history that was never released. It was supposed to be released, I think, but it's out now. Yeah. Yeah, but there was in the files you see a strong level of dissatisfaction with that history, from the British side. That there were really real shortcomings to that Ehrman history, and so there was a need to correct that history in some ways, and that's what Gowing was doing as well. But I haven't really gone into that story.
Can I just pick up on Laurie? I went and stayed with the Hewletts a couple of times. I never got a sense in Maryland. I never got a sense that they were kind of doing it with any kind of bitterness, or I think I remember Mum talking about him always with a great deal of both professional and personal affection, even if there were issues to do with the content, which I never got into.
But what she brings out wonderfully is this sense of Anglo-American tension and rivalry in the war years, and the fact that there are great suspicions, you know, which often are great suspicions about the commercial exploitation of this technology in the post-war world, and how sensitive the Americans were to that issue. And that was an important part of the bargaining.
Just on this, I had a conversation with Mike George Bundy about the comparison of the British and the American official histories. And he was very much in praise of Margaret's history. And one of the points I remember is she understood government. Mm. And actually, that's an extremely important aspect of it.
That's true.
Robert Fox. I was Margaret's successor in the chair of history of science at Oxford. My question was, I think it still goes down the patriotism theme a little bit. Did you come across any evidence of Margaret having a residual sympathy for the French predicament in this story and the cutting out of the French?
Yeah.
Because she had a very close personal friendship with Bertrand Goldschmidt, for example, and I think with some others in France. And I was working in Paris in the mid-80s, and I remember her coming over and giving a really memorable talk, obviously about her book. But I wonder if you have any sense of sympathy or sort of... particular insights into
I think she wants to bring that story out, the fact that there were choices made in the war years which had tremendous significance for the direction of the post-war British programme, to not collaborate with the French, particularly in early 1945. There's this decision point being reached, and the way she portrays that is that there was a kind of crossroads point, and there was room for a debate about which direction to go in, whether to really work towards Anglo-American cooperation and collaboration after the war, or to move closer in some ways to the French. And it's interesting, in the files there's correspondence from, it might be from Penny actually, there's a letter to her that was written after the publication of this, where he says, look, there was really no... No, it's from Makins, that's right, it's from Makins. Makins, of course, who's in, involved in these decisions at the time. He says that there was really no choice to make. He said, we were much more settled on collaborating with the Americans. And in some way, your stress and emphasis here on the possible French route is the wrong stress, as far as he would say. And he had some very mild, not really criticisms, really sort of observations about the approach he'd taken to certain subjects. And Makins did not feel... that was really how things felt to him at the time. Anyway, that's what he said.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, I think that, well, been various references to Anglo-American tensions, right? But obviously one reason for that was Nanmei, Fuchs, and so on. And in the papers about the writing of the book, is there a reflection of how much she was in on discussions about that, or the question of the treachery question?
Yeah. There's not much on that in the wartime volume. There's a lot more in the, in these volumes.
No, in what you've seen about the sort of background papers, right?
Yeah, I mean, also there's a question about what access she's really... I mean, it's difficult because, the files are not complete in what you can see, but I don't get the sense she had much access to security. She actually disavows the fact that she's not really going to discuss intelligence. I mean, in the first volume, that's not an area that she goes into, or, it's the intelligence security side. But it's an area, the security side is something she does in the post-war volumes. And she on the vetting side, it's interesting because her account of the whole spies episode that she writes up, they run it past the, this is all in open files, they run it past the security service, and they say, fine, happy, no problems, no changes, nothing, it's so there was a sort of a relaxed attitude about her attitude to, about her approach there. There's a letter from Groves to her where he mentions he was interested to observe that Fuchs had been given some kind of security vetting before he was sent to out to America. And he said, I was interested to read that because, of course, he's... in fact, he says when he writes to her about this volume, I'll be very interested to see how you handle the Fuchs case in the subsequent, because I think that obviously that was still a very sensitive point with him. So, yeah. I mean, those do play out in the correspondence.
I think... Yes.
Yes, Richard Moore from King's. We've already just John mentioned Lorna, and I was going to ask you, Matthew, something about how Lorna and Margaret worked together and how they divided up the work.
We certainly shouldn't. This is a collaborative work. But what I understood from the files is that Lorna Arnold. I mean, you must, of course, 1966. Margaret Gowing goes to Kent, University of Kent, as a reader in history. And she continues to work, she has a retainer from the AEA to continue work on the post-war volumes. But by then, Arnold is in place as her sort of replacement archivist at the AEA, which is why they're collaborating together. But Margaret Gowing is torn between her, new responsibilities at Kent and her, desire and wish to complete this sort of successor volume on the early post-war years. So what tends to happen is a division of labour where Margaret Gowing concentrates on Volume 1, which is entitled Policy Making, so she covers the kind of high politics of nuclear weapons issues and atomic energy issues after the war, and Volume 2 is more Lorna Arnold's area of concentration, which is on policy execution. How was the policy implemented in practice, the atomic plants, the engineering and a nuclear site of the whole program, and the weapons program. That's more Lorna Arnold's field. And she had I think Lorna Arnold had more of a scientific knowledge and training by then because of the work she'd done in the 1960s earlier on for the AEA as well.
I think Roy McLeod does capture the spirit of the relationship very well in the monograph.
Well, that brings us to lunchtime, and just to say thank you for a wonderful paper and discussion. Yes.